Welcome to episode 31 of Paper Talk, a monthly series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the field of hand papermaking and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and today I'm talking with Lawrence Barker, an influencer in the field of hand papermaking. Born in 1930, Barker went to Principia College and got his MFA from Cranbrook, where he also ended up teaching from 1960 to 1970 and ran the first classes in hand papermaking at the college level in the United States. Several students and others who visited that studio went on to become luminaries in the field of hand papermaking. A theme that came up often during our conversation was the way in which Barker followed his intuition. After college, he wrote a letter to Stanley Hayter at Atelier 17 in Paris about the potential of studying with him. He never heard back, but he went to Paris anyways, looked up Hayter, and was able to study with him. Later, he wrote a letter to Dard Hunter asking whether he knew of a beater he might use to set up a papermaking studio at Cranbrook, and Dard Hunter found one for him. And after reading James Michener's book, Iberia, which describes Spain as a place centered around the book, Barker surmised that printing would follow the book, so he moved overseas and started a papermaking studio in Spain. And he was right. Enjoy our conversation. Lawrence Barker, welcome to Paper Talk. It's great to have you here. I want to start out just talking a little bit about your background, just briefly, your childhood, where you grew up, and what you studied in college, sort of how your interest in paper began.
Right. Well, where do we begin? My daughter lives in Texas, and when I go down there, she's a great bridge player, and she drags me to tournaments and things. Ah. And every so often, people will say, gee, your accent, I don't, where are you from? And I say, I know I talk funny, but I'm Texan, because I was born in Houston. I don't much sound like it. But I grew up in Long Island in Great Neck. My father was English. He later naturalized. My mother, American. Ustado Uridense. When you're in Spain, you learn not to say American because it covers a number of countries and continents. So I grew up in Great Neck and I went to Principia College. Outside of St. Louis, lovely school.
And now, how did you get over there from New York?
My father was working for NBC.
Okay.
And by the way, I'm going to throw this in. I know it sounds like a joke, but I truly could be the oldest person on planet Earth who has seen television over the most number of years, the greatest number of years. Why? My father was working with an engineering team and they put television on the air in the 30s.
Uh-huh.
So we had a factory console in our house. I mean, only the engineers could have had them.
Right. Wow.
And the engineers had kids. Possibly I'm among the remaining children of those engineers alive.
Right.
Great distinction, right?
Yes, that's fascinating.
So that's... And then in 1947, my father got a construction permit from the FCC to found his own radio station in Freeport, Illinois.
Okay.
Which happened to have been my mother's hometown. So we all moved from Long Island to Freeport. In 1947, I had a year left of high school, and then I went to a Principia College.
Okay, that makes sense.
And just had a a liberal arts curriculum, you know. Mm-hmm. But I took some art courses in the last 2 years.
Right.
And consulted with, you know, my instructors, and they pointed me toward Cranbrook.
Uh-huh.
I applied, I got in. Today, I'm sure I wouldn't, based on my portfolio at the time. So, these are things that just happened, and I went to Cranbrook.
Right.
Now, in those days, you could get an MFA in painting in 1 year. The other departments were 2 years. So, summer of 54, then 55, I'm leaving in May or at the end of summer school. They had a summer school then, and I was taking ceramics for extra fun. And I went to Paris to study etching and engraving with Stanley William Hayter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, life is so funny. I wrote to him, of course, asking if I could. He never even answered. So I still went to Paris and I looked him up and there he was. And he said, sure, come by on Monday sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
I had a marvelous year in Paris. Returned to New York, went by Cranbrook just to visit, and Fred Mitchell, who was the other painting instructor at the time, had an apartment on Front Street, just off the wall, over a Hero standing shop. And I sublet for a year at 128 Front Street. And later, when they were running nostalgia pieces on Quinty's Slip, which was just further along front ends up in Quinty's Slip. And there I met Fred's friends, Ellsworth Kelly.
Oh, okay.
And his friend Bob Clark, who had studied at Edinburgh and blah, blah, blah. And about that time, I mean, the next year, I went for my first teaching job at Miami University.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I must have been in the library thumbing through art magazines. And I discovered that Bob Clark, upon moving into a loft with his seven cats or something, found all these stencils and he became Robert Indiana. I didn't know him as Robert Indiana. I just knew him as Bob Clark. He was doing Reginald Marsh-like.
Was there a picture of him? Is that how you made the connection?
A picture of him? In what sense?
Well, did it say in the article that Bob Clark became Robert Indiana?
Yes, it must have.
Okay.
But I mean, theretofore, and when I left New York, he was doing, you know, studies of derelict seamen on benches in Quinty's Park. There was a Seamen's Institute over the park. And, so 3 years go by, and one day I receive a call from Zoltán Sepesi, president of Cranbrook. He had been my painting instructor. And he said, Lawrence, are you firmly ensconced in Oxford, Ohio? I said, no, not necessarily. And so that led to my coming back, and Cranbrook wanted to make what theretofore had been a printmaking service department, as it were, for interested students. There was an etching press, a lithography press. And John D. Martelli from Michigan State would come over on a Thursday evening and all day Friday to teach lithography in the fall quarter. So I just became more and more interested in printmaking. And as I say, I graduated, went to Paris, was in New York, had a few years of teaching at Miami. I was called back to make the printmaking department full-fledged.
Okay, and so were you teaching printmaking as well?
That was it, I was head.
You were head and you were teaching.
Yes.
Right.
And do you want me to go into paper?
Yeah, so then I think a student showed you a sheet of paper.
An older woman, Daga Ramsey, her husband, Bob, was getting an MFA in painting. They both were older, an older couple.
Mm-hmm.
And she lived in Sag Harbor, and my parents lived in Sag Harbor. So the following summer, I'm sorry, I kind of jumped ahead. She gave me a sheet of Douglas Howell's paper.
Okay. She had met him?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Knew him. And I thought it wonderful. I wrote to Mr. Howell, I would like to apprentice myself if I might. I'm here with printmaking, blah, blah, blah. And he said, yes, come by in the summer. I'm going to give a seminar for 4 or 5 people. I turned up and all the others had canceled.
Okay.
There was Douglas on one end of the log and I was on the other.
Uh-huh. And what did you do? You were there 2 weeks?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just terrible what I'm going to say. No, but I arrived and in short order, the house was empty except for Timothy. And we played ping pong.
His son.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Seriously, a psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
Along with his wife. When I entered, I saw on the walls of his living room a print of Albrecht Dürer that the Met had lent him, the block, because Douglas had done a lot of work with the Metropolitan Museum.
Mm-hmm.
And also there was one of his, you know, I should have looked this up. I always stumble with this word, papistries, or from a play on words of paper and tapestries.
Papetry or something. It's a word he constructed. Yeah, right. I've seen that. Okay.
Maybe that's why I don't remember it.
Right.
I think he put in some extra syllables or something. Yes, but, and I thought that was the most wonderful, among the most wonderful things Howell had done.
So that was more artwork than just a sheet of paper.
I hadn't even walked downstairs. And I did that. And with every step going down, I would be casting glances left and right.
Wow.
There was a vat, another step, and then to the left, oh my heavens, shelves full of beautiful paper. And there was a machine. I didn't even yet know the name of the Hollander beater. Talk about green around the gills. But as I reached the bottom step, I got it. I got the big picture. This is manageable. This can all be done in a modest space.
And is that what your intention was?
Well, sure.
You thought that you would be taking that back to Cranbrook, right?
A very nice adjunct to our printmaking program.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And the sheet, I want to just talk a little bit about that. So the sheet of paper that, I forgot the woman's name.
Daga.
That Daga showed you, that was just a sheet of paper.
Oh, yes, but it was one of...
it was...
crinkly.
Yes, right. So that planted the seed that, paper could be different and interesting.
Absolutely, that was
right.
Yes.
Okay, so go ahead and talk about what you did during those 2 weeks.
Well.
Was it structured and planned out, or was it?
Yes, it was.
Uh-huh.
For the first week, I think, was, may have been linen cloth.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second week was cotton. So okay. I guess I tore it up. I can't remember that part. But right. Then standing over his beater and feeding it in slowly. And then as it all got entangled, you know, pulling it apart so extra large knots wouldn't form.
Right.
All that was very good. And Douglas, to his credit, he strictly adhered to, I guess, the general view that he didn't want to just dole out answers.
Uh-huh.
I asked him about something. He said, just observe. And that's what I did. I had plenty of time to meditate as the slurry goes around and around.
All right.
Yeah. So I made 5 days of small sheets.
Mm-hmm.
Linen and another of cotton. And when I left, there still was some damp sheets. I stopped off at Tanya Grossman's Universal Art Editions Limited.
Right.
And I remember...
Which was where at that point?
Not out on Long Island.
Okay. In the area,
yeah. I'm going out now to my parents.
Right.
They're living in summertime. I've come from by myself. Now I'm going out to my parents in Sag Harbor. And I stopped off at Grossman, and she was ever so nice and interested, of course, in paper, and said if I'm ever making it commercially, give her a call. And Bob Blackburn, who was printing, I think Rauschenberg was there that day, if I'm not mistaken, said, you know, Tata, you should have called ahead. Well, hell, I wasn't call ahead. I'm just driving east.
Right.
On my way. And so, jumping ahead, I never really did make paper for Tanya. I'm not too sure why, but she was always complimentary. Okay, so now I go out to Long Island, and Dogger Ramsey has a little cocktail party, and her neighbor, one of her two neighbors, was John Steinbeck. So it was fun seeing him. Uh-huh. His voice was deep in his throat. I really had a hard time understanding exactly what he was talking about, but I thought it was about ghosts.
Okay.
Around Monterey. Ghosts, not house ghosts. I mean, general ghosts in the air, in the maritime air. I don't know what he was talking about, frankly, but he was certainly entertaining. So I returned to Cranbrook.
Wait, now, didn't you stop by Dard Hunter's on that way back? Or that was another time?
Oh, it would have been another time.
Okay.
We were already making paper at Cranbrook.
Okay, all right.
I mean, I spent the 60s, the month of August in every year of the 60s at my parents'.
Okay, got it. So you went back to Cranbrook.
Went to Cranbrook, wrote to Dard Hunter, the only name I had, the only name I knew. It was probably cheeky, but I mean, I'm just out there and I don't know what's going on anywhere.
Yeah.
Dr. Lewis replied, explaining Dard Hunter, I think, was in Puerto Rico, cataloging Cunabula, what's it called? In Espanol, no recuerdo. You know, the... Yeah.
Cunabula.
Yes, that was it. And, but he said, yes, we have a Hollander beater. We'll send it along. We'll clean it up and send it along. And so that was the kind of beginning.
And Dard Hunter had an extra Hollander beater? Or where did it come from?
Institute of Paper Chemistry.
Oh, the Institute of Paper Chemistry.
Museum. It was up in Appleton.
That's right. Okay. Okay.
Right. So that was very nice.
So you set up shop.
Yeah.
What about your molds and deckles and your fiber? You know, where did you get all that?
The fiber? Oh, yeah. I'll tell you where we got fiber. Walking up and down the street, tapping the neighbors. I'm making that kind of a story. I mean, I got my wife's old rags and rags from a few friends and stuff. And I want to come back to this point, this very point, by the time I get to Spain. But now where are we? Yes. And then we use some linter.
Uh-huh.
Rags and linter.
And the linter you got from the industry?
Does Cheney, the name Cheney? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I still use it. You can still get it, yep.
Okay. Wet laps, or whatever they're called. It almost comes on a on its own wooden platform. It seems to me they weighed a lot. They were coming.
Oh, you got a whole pallet of it? It was wet or dry?
Well, both, but I recall wet.
Okay. No, I get it in sheet form now.
Sure. But. Yeah. No, very unprepossessing as it came in. I think it almost rolled over on itself or something. I don't know.
Right.
It was rough.
Yeah. And so how did the students respond?
They responded as you might expect them to, with curiosity and range of enthusiasm. But I think generally they liked it, sure.
Right. And Douglas just, it sounds like Douglas just showed you how to make sheets.
Yes.
And is that what you did with your students? And how did the artistic part come in?
Right. Well, we started to, well, in the first place, you start to make paper in the beginning And it's also exciting, and you see all these threads. So you start to make paper, possibly not having beaten the pulp as mm-hmm. much as later you would do.
Right.
It was just also exciting. It was like nutty bread or something. You know, you just.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, something you look back on and you're like, oh, that was really ugly. Yeah. but you're really excited because it's
the blue and green threads.
Yeah.
Going around. So we did that, and we did a certain amount of separation with stencils to get a two-tone effect, two areas.
Uh-huh.
I did. And in my work, I was shaping, I would have stencils to make triangular shapes and other geometric shapes.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, that was probably what I was doing most of in the 60s, just controlling the outer shape of the print.
Right.
Lithographs, woodcuts, principally.
Mm-hmm. And were you in contact with other artists working around the country at that time?
Paper?
Not paper. I don't think there were many, right?
No.
No, I'm thinking of painters that worked, were kind of breaking the boundaries of painting.
No. I mean, soon enough, when I got to Spain, I was making paper for Ken Tyler, who was mm-hmm, mm-hmm. putting the paper into the hands of, you know, all those people.
Yeah.
All those people.
Okay. So you were at Cranbrook for 10 years in that position. And did anything change between year one and year 10, kind of in the paper studio, or did it just kind of move along?
It still was largely oriented toward prints. And of course, with Walter Hamady, mm-hmm. 1965, and just before I had bought, with Cranbrook money, bought out a print workshop in some little town in Western Michigan, and we hauled these type cases and type back. So, We really had a proto book program, book arts. That term I didn't learn until decades later. But I mean, and I would ask my students if they would, and they all do. It wasn't a requirement, but they all fell into the spirit of making paper, setting a modest amount of type with an accompanying illustration. A great experience.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'd love to do it right now.
Yeah, and are you saying that Walter kind of took that to form?
Well, my goodness, Perishable Press.
Yeah. Right.
It had 50 years at it.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
But it started there.
Well, I would like to think so.
Okay, who else came through there that went on to do more with paper?
Well, John Kohler, certainly, mm-hmm. With his mill in Connecticut, he was collaborating with Ken Tyler.
Right.
And I'm not aware of all the collaborations he made, but collaborating with, I think, Kelly and other artists
mm-hmm.
of Tyler's. And I think Charlie Pachter went back to Toronto, and I think he may have set up some paper making facilities.
Okay.
I'm not sure. Aris Katrulis was very instrumental down at Wayne for getting Catherine Clark involved.
Right, right.
Twin Rocker.
Mm-hmm. And Tim Barrett and Winifred Lutz?
Oh, Tim Barrett. Is the world listening? Because
yes, I hope
because
so.
I want to say, Tim, bless his heart, says to me that one of the inflection points in his career in paper came when he, as a student from Cranbrook School for Boys, drifted over as I like to say, the DMZ, the academy area, and came into our department and saw papermaking, and I guess it caught his fancy.
Uh-huh.
So it contributed somewhat.
Okay, so he didn't actually do anything there. He just witnessed it.
But you can see how quick I am to take credit.
Oh, absolutely. You were there. You introduced him. And what's the story with Winifred Lutz? Was she at Cranbrook?
This is another wonderful story. She did beautiful. Yes, she was at Cranbrook, and she was in the sculpture department.
Okay.
And printmaking was her. In those days, you can't say it now, but we had majors and minors. Well, nothing is minor, is it? So, but in scheduling, it was one day a week for MFA students. And Winifred came over, and she had had previous experience making paper.
Mm-hmm.
The word banana sticks in my mind.
Oh, abaca, maybe.
Abaca.
Mm-hmm.
You know, evidently, I must have been out sick the day the world learned about abaca, because I know nothing about it. It's never come into my studio that I know of. I've made paper from different kinds of hemp and stuff.
All right.
But anyway, so now where are we? We're still in the 60s at Cranbrook?
Yeah, but let's move on, because I don't want this to be too long. So I just want to talk about, it just seems like this still happens when someone leaves a department. So you left Cranbrook to go to Spain.
Yes.
The facility goes away.
Yes, my successor got rid of it, yes. And Walter Hamady bought Peter, and he took it up to Wisconsin. Now, I don't think his papermaking program was officially under the university aegis. I think he was doing it on the side. But look at all the people.
Oh, that came out of there. Yes, incredible, incredible.
Yes.
So what took you to Spain?
Oh, well, it's kind of a long story for...
Okay, let's shorten it.
So we're going to Spain now. The ship is leaving. We have 23 suitcases and trunks. And oh, child, we did it so badly in that sense. Okay, so we go to Spain. Here's what we did. I read James Michener's Iberia. And it pointed out that Barcelona was the reputed publishing capital of Spain. And with fingers crossed, metaphorically, I was hoping prints would follow books and that the publishers would be there. And that is exactly how it turned out. Because in all of Madrid, in those days, there was only Grupo 15. But in Barcelona, you had Sala Gaspar, you had Polígrafa, Ediciones Polígrafa, and the place was jumping with activity there. So it turned out to be fun, perfect.
Uh-huh. And you set up a paper studio?
Indeed, I did. I was prepared to import a 1.5 Valley Iron beater. But after a year of living in Barcelona, I went out to the paper mill for the first time in Capellades, 1 hour to the west.
Okay.
And from there, a wonderful situation. And everyone should go there if they're in Barcelona, certainly.
It's still around, yeah.
Oh, very much so. And they have a nice program and art program and everything. Victoria Raval is the director.
Right.
Anyone can write to her. So I found the name of, I was given the name of a paper machinist, and I stopped by his shop in Molins de Rey, on the way back from Capellades to Barcelona. And I said, Senor Prats, do you have a Hollander beater? He said, yes. I said, well, may I see it? He says, yes. I said, well, where is it? Well, there in the corner. So I look and there's just a jumble of machinery. There's no tub because these things are built in situ.
Hey, listeners, let's take a little break here. And I want to make sure that you know about the 2019 12 Months of Paper how-to book and calendar. Join a DIY paper community and create fun and beautiful paper objects for your home or to give as gifts. The calendar is filled with 12 fun paper projects for the whole family to create together. And an additional custom paper pack features a curated collection of decorated papers from around the world. Go to HelenHebertStudio.com/shop and click on the 12 Months of Paper link to get your calendar.
You're not buying a completed.
Right.
So back in my studio, when these workers came to install it, so to speak, they had a smile on their face. They had never put together such a small Hollander beater. They were 100 kilos, and this was a 10 kilo.
Beater. Wow.
Mm-hmm. And a glorious thing, built like a, you know what, solid brick.
Yeah.
And so that was 22 pounds.
Right.
22 pounder.
And what was the minimum amount you could put in there?
Good point. You need, because of the rise in mm-hmm. the floor, you need a minimum amount of water. I never measured it, but with the beater filled, I could probably run, and I did often, mm-hmm. One third. Mm-hmm. Of course, you never put in 22 pounds of rag. These beaters aren't categorized for rag. A 1.5 pound, you can't put 1.5 pounds of linen into a valley iron beater.
Right. And how did you?
At a terribly slow rate.
Yeah. How did you cut the rag fiber?
Well, of course, I set up a blade and a vise on my bench. I did a lot of that. But Barcelona is also historically has been a textile center. So mm-hmm. on the other side of Tibidabo, on the other side of the mountain, in Sabadell and Terrassa, there are these wonderful small, located in industrial parts often, shops. Where they take cuttings from the textile industry, and I don't have the vocabulary.
They shred it.
They get it back to
fiber.
So they have these giant, beautiful guillotines.
Uh huh.
And right. So you have a moving bed, and you just can throw all your rag there. And these great, slicing motions of the guillotine chops it all up, and you do it again, and you may do it a third time to guarantee you don't have any long strings.
Right.
So that's really how I cut rag.
Uh-huh. And so you were in Spain for how long? 10 years? 20 years?
25 years.
25 years.
The first time. Then we moved back to Sarasota in 1995. With my wife's health in decline, she died 2 years later, 1997. But I had brought all my equipment to Sarasota, and it was set up there, and I was working.
Okay, wait, let's go back. Let's talk about the Spain, those 25 years. What? So you went to, for the publishing, to try to establish something, and so what happened?
Well, I knew one of Miró's printers, mm-hmm. Joan Barbera, who in turn was a friend of a friend. And I just gave him paper to try. Mm-hmm. Barbera printed there was a wonderful gentleman, Gustavo Gili. He was a very close friend of Picasso's. It's said that when Picasso died, whoever was Madame Picasso, the first call she made was to Gili, to
mm-hmm.
him on
the day. Right.
That was the Picasso connection, principal connection. And Gilly was a very close friend of Miró, but Gilly's empire was really based upon scientific textbooks. But he had this fine arts thing going on the side because he was friends of Picasso and Miró and blah, blah.
Right, right.
So I got paper into his world and I made paper for Miró. I was making paper first for Ken Tyler. For my very first commercial launch was the four-panel Jasper John lithograph, flagstone lithograph. Okay. And I'll point out that it was on display at the Basel, not Miami, Basel.
Yeah.
Switzerland. At the Gemini Gallery. Mm-hmm. It was there the second year as well. And I said to Sidney Felsen, I thought the whole purpose of this exercise was to bring out new work. It's another year. He says, yes, but perhaps you don't know that in the intervening year, Jasper started painting the flagstone series in oils and stuff. And they became very popular.
Uh-huh.
So it was worthwhile showing this lithograph, four panel lithograph. And he said it was the interesting exception to the rule being an artist develops a style on canvas and then makes prints, if he's a painter, right? And
right.
Here, the first statement was in graphic form.
Ah, right.
And then the paintings followed.
Right.
Nice little switcheroo.
Yeah, I remember reading that. Fascinating. Yeah. I forgot to ask you what kind of, where your molds and decals came from.
They came from, on that very first visit to Capellades, the director gave me the name of Enrique Alegre,
mm-hmm.
who had a wire factory nearby. I went there, great guy, wonderful times. And he made all these molds for me for nothing. I gave him art.
Yeah.
I was so appreciative. And he said, about the watermark, are you going to make thick paper or thin paper? I said, for heaven's sakes, I'm sure I'll be making every kind of paper.
Mm-hmm.
So he chose a shim stock of some sort, and they were all, it was an overhand nut, and it was all sawed out, jigsawed out by someone in his shop and stuff. I mean, so, totally professional. And on those first example papers I sent to Tyler, he said, get rid of the watermark. It's coming up as a ghost, you know.
These
were bleed prints.
The artist doesn't want it in their work. Yeah, let's mention that to listeners that don't know much about watermarks, that historically there was always a watermark on the mold. That's why this mold maker asked you that. Yeah.
And so later when I wanted to watermark a paper on that same mold, now it doesn't have that beautifully sawed and sewn onto the mold watermark, I would just cut out a facsimile in 3, 4, 5 layers of masking tape and place it in. And it sounds primitive, and so it is, but at least you can choose your thickness. And that can.
Right.
No, that's nice.
Right. And when I worked at Dudonné, I don't know where this came from down the line, if you showed someone what you were doing or if someone else, they would layer contact paper, like the shelf lining paper.
Okay, same idea. Right.
But you could get bigger pieces, right, than masking tape.
Yeah.
And cut watermarks from that.
Oh, yes, you could do a number with that. So, go ahead.
Well, we need to kind of move along. So tell me about one interesting collaboration or paper that you made. Did these artists ever come over, or you were just
the
specification?
I must say that the only collaboration I never really had. Yes, I did too. Gee, I'm sorry. Miro came to my studio once in the company of Senor Ferrar. He was the director of the MEG gallery. MEG, M-A-E-G-H-T. And okay. He was Miro's Parisian dealer. And I think MEG really set up a big, beautiful gallery in Barcelona to keep Miro happy. Mm-hmm. But it was one of those palacetes, little palaces on Calle Moncada, where the Picasso Museum is, and uh-huh. there's a costume museum across the street. Fabulous buildings with more interior space than there was out on the street.
Wow, yeah.
So Miro came with the director of the Met Gallery, and Miro said to me he wanted imperfect paper where there were accidents. And of course, you know what I'm saying to myself in my thought balloon. Oh boy, have you come to the right place? I could unload all of these papers with little telltale wrinkles or twists. Oh. And then I said to him, well, if you like accidents, why don't you make some of your own? And of course, you know, he stood about 5 feet two. Uh-huh. I know I'm speaking, I don't mean to speak irreverently of a legend, so I don't want to be too flippant. But he really had bird-like movements almost. Mm-hmm. And he said, how, como? And so here, come over here. And I formed a sheet of paper on a plastic mold, on a plastic screen that fits just under the mold so that such papers can be hung to dry. They don't go through the press.
Oh, okay.
That's how you preserve surfaces. Mm-hmm. And you still keep it flat. And so I mean, really, he had the exact same expression as anyone would who sees paper in liquid form for the first time.
Right.
We started splashing around like any uh-huh. four-year-old in a mud pie or something. And he did two of those. I hung the screens to dry. And when they were dry, I delivered the paper to Galleria Meg. And I heard months later that there was a Miro drawing show and that my paper, these two pieces, were in it. So as I walked down Calle Moncada, wondering what will Miro have done to the paper, which already is very active. Mm-hmm. I found out when I went in, and it was a great show because he was using all kinds of substrates, all the different papers. Mm. And there were the two that he had made in my studio, and they were beautiful. And he had just added some grafismo, some strokes with China ink, India ink. Uh-huh. Boom, boom. Signed it perfect. Uh-huh. It wouldn't have been perfect on a blank sheet of paper, but this is now suddenly
right. He's activating the surface. Yeah. Okay, and now let's talk about your artwork. So all this time you were continuing to make work and yes. show and sell work as well.
I sold editions to Poligrafa, Ediciones Poligrafa, and then Poligrafa asked me to make paper for a Miro book. Mm. Cantique al Sol, Song to the Sun, or something in Catalan. And Miro did an interesting thing. The paper was grayish, purplish, and it had some threads in it that he liked to. And that was the text paper. Uh-huh. And he used a mold-made paper for his etchings. Papier arche.
Oh, okay.
Or guarro. Guarro would be the Spanish paper equivalent of arch or reed.
Right, right.
Okay, so it was a very nice combination.
Uh-huh. And what was the edition size? Small?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I say that casually. I mean, I don't know, but 50? Maybe
right.
100? Right. I don't know. But guarro in Spanish with a small g means dirty. Guarro. Oh. And so when I would drive from Barcelona to a mill in outside of town there, where I made the Jasper Johns big, large paper. Mm-hmm. I would pass, you could see from the highway looking down the paper mill, Guaro. I mean, a big modern thing with, you know, steam belching out and all stuff. And of course, I would have fun. This is my little inside joke. I would say, Guaro, dirty paper. Ha ha ha. Anyway.
So this was a, you mentioned this John's paper, but I don't know that we've talked about that before. So he, this was through Ken Tyler, and he wanted a large,
yes,
large sheet that you couldn't do yourself. So you,
this is after Tyler's stay. In fact, that first order for Ken Tyler in 1972 or three, when I was ready to send it to Los Angeles, I called for shipping directions, and the secretary or someone says, an uncomfortable silence followed. Ken Tyler doesn't work here anymore. Oh my God. I felt like something out of the Twilight Zone where cosmonauts are coming back to Earth and I can remember when they left. No, Sid Felsen wanted the paper he was writing for. It. So it was Sid Felsen who asked me, and Stanley Grinstein, I'm sorry, they were partners. They are partners. Asked me to make this large paper, about 5 feet by 3.5.
Okay. And so you did that at another facility?
Yes, it was Lorenzo Bendrell, older paper maker, who had just stopped making paper commercially, but he had all these facilities. He was the last hand linter maker. He was making linters up until the end. But finally, his operation was shut down because he was polluting the streams with his stuff.
And so you mean he was like hand forming sheets?
But it was an artisanal operation in that his máquina bomba, the mold making machine, which is called a bombo.
Okay.
You walk in there. Remy Green, father of Simon Green of handmade paper in Kent, when he came by, he was down in the basement, and there's some really old beaters, no longer used. I mean, they are really rotted out, rusted, mm-hmm. rotted, and everything else. And there's this huge belt, you know, for driving the motor. And there's a Frankenstein-like switch for turning on the electricity. It's really scary down there. And Remy couldn't stop giggling. He said, in England, we closed mills like this 100 years ago or something. Well, it was alive and well in Catalonia. So yes, Senor Bendrell, I would buy linters from him.
Okay, and then when you moved to Florida, we need to wrap up in the next 5 to 10 minutes. So when you moved to Florida, you continued to make work?
I had the Hollander reconstructed so beautifully. I think that the second iteration was even better than the first. So, I can't say that because it never caused me problems in either location. It's just beautiful. Oh, yes, I was making my own work. I did a little bit of commercial stuff. I can't remember for whom.
And were you represented by different galleries or?
Not too much. I don't really have much of a gallery history. I still have some work in Sweden.
Okay, well, and talk a little bit about your interest in the surface, and I know you were breaking through the surface and changing the shape, just kind of the philosophy behind you.
Okay, here's an immediate problem I had. Making paper soft enough for lithography printing. Mm-hmm. Everyone prints dry, and they've been printing dry for a long time. Mm-hmm. But there was a time you would dampen paper for lithic, but Okay, so you cannot have wrinkles being formed, hard wrinkles. So a certain amount of curvature in the paper is tolerable and will iron out nicely in the printing. But you go one step too far and the wave breaks, as it were, and you have a hard wrinkle. And I only misjudged once. So the trick is to be able to control the hydration, the point of hydration. And I would go to a rag mill shop, Hospitalet, on the industrial outskirts of Barcelona. And I could stand there, the owner let me, with my eyes closed, and you can judge rag. You know how easy it is to tear, pull apart, how soft your paper is going to be.
Right.
I have a 10-kilo beater. I can't spend days and nights tearing rag, putting them into categories. I'll go nuts. So, Senor Bennett, I'm not too sure of his name. He had a contract with Hospital San Pablo, St. Peter's Hospital, for the rag, for the sheets. But industrial operations like that, a hospital, they give up their sheets way before a housewife let go of her rags. In other words, they're still harder. So what do I do? What would you do? Well, my solution was to add about a 5 to 8%, maybe 10, of artificial fiber. It's like adding breadcrumbs to ground meat to make a.
So what do you mean? What was it?
Giant hamburger. So you're cutting down the.
Right. What was the artificial fiber you used?
Anything.
Okay.
I mean, nylon, rayon, Dacron, I don't know. They all blended. I'll tell you what doesn't blend, and I've tried it, but putting in wool, the little wool fibers rise up and form a scum on top of it. And by the way, it sounds like a cop-out, artificial fiber. The beater never works harder than to break that stuff
down. Oh, I know. I've tried.
If I want a gray paper for Jasper Johns or anyone else, I would break the pulp in stages like this. Stage one with maybe 2 or 3 kilos only of hard rag, might be black. I'm making gray paper, black rag or dark brown, or black, okay. And maybe some white, I don't know. Second stage would be the bed sheets sort of thing. And then the final third would be linters. How I arrived at this, I don't know. But I think cooks instinctively do the same thing. You put into your blender the walnuts first, not at the end.
Right.
Protected, and they go around, you'll never get them. So that was the same guiding principle.
And there's this expression, make paper is made in the beater. So that is a really good example of that.
And then once you've made the paper, then forming sheets is donkey work.
Right.
And it's nice. I mean, my mind could fly around the galaxy. Ha ha. Anywhere, anything but. No, you've learned how to. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
And you get better at it. And
right.
But here's a quick example. I had a couple of young men printing etchings of other artists. I was doing this for Polygrapher also. And I said to John Patterson, come on over here, my back is killing me. Here, form a sheet of paper. And it was double elephant. It was 29 by 40, sort of. But I had a sling, a counterweight.
Okay.
Enter into a cradle, it clicks.
Right.
Push it under. He had never made paper. He didn't know anything. And as you might expect, his first two sheets weren't any good. But by the third or fourth, they were.
Right.
They were They were keepers. But if you read Wattman's book on the apprenticeship of a paper maker, I mean, they spend more time doing that.
Making sheets.
Than doctors do in a neurosurgery residency. It's like 7 years. But then, of course, you read between the lines. You start reading the small print, and they're throwing blankets, belts, for the first 2 years. And they're doing, finally, in the fifth year, standing at the bat. Yeah, that sort of stuff. But if you have a mechanical help like that, I mean, forget about it.
Yeah, right.
Would Joe do that all day long? Of course not.
Right, right. So that comment brings me, reminds me of what I read that Dard Hunter said to you. You wrote this article about Dard and Douglas, and that anyone can make paper, something to that effect.
It was more pointed. I think any fool can make paper.
Any fool can make paper.
I must have irritated him. Something had set him off. And thank goodness, that's my response.
Uh-huh, right. I mean,
it's deliciously low tech.
It is.
And if you're an artist, you're after your art, you go beyond the sheet of paper you formed. But if you consider yourself just a paper maker, then you're going to get into the weeds with all the endless subtleties that are there. Mm-hmm. They are wonderful. But that's not everyone's end game.
Right, and I wonder why, you know, well, so you were instrumental in, you had the first college program with hand paper making, yeah. And now today there are more, but it's still not that prolific.
Well, there you go. I was just thinking about that recently. I have the faintest idea. I think Sue Gosin years ago published some sort of a survey.
Yeah, of all the colleges. But they ebb and flow. So like when you left, it left Cranbrook. I had a student actually that went to Cranbrook, and I think she made paper there. So, you know, things come and go. But yeah, it's interesting. I think the equipment is expensive if you really are serious about it. And I think that's a block. That's why it doesn't.
But how much does an etching press cost? A litho press.
It's true.
Especially if it's on the large size. You're talking thousands of dollars these days.
Yeah, right.
Of course, to someone who's old, everything seems expensive in comparison.
Well, and I was also thinking about Douglas, Dard, and you, and how Dard Hunter maybe was more of the historian. And Douglas was more scientific, and then you more artistic.
Well, that's maybe that's slightly too crude.
I know they overlap. But yeah,
they sure do. And yes. There's no question that Douglas most assuredly had his artistic.
Oh side. Yes, right.
But you're safe to say, I think that Dard Hunter was more classic and European. Everything came from England, I think.
Right.
His molds, is this, is that. And,
you know. Traditional, yeah.
And it's probably because somehow, I guess there never was made a university connection to his museum. I mean, he was out there in left field by himself. Mm-hmm. With his collections and his books, and it just somehow didn't enter
right
art department. That
right
vehicle.
Yeah, that's true.
So it certainly helps to have a university behind you. In one
sure. Side, you know. Right. And what about you today? Are you?
I'm doing things that are on commercial paper. Mm-hmm. I'm not printing, and I'm very happy doing it, by the way. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm really very happy to have moved on, you know.
Yeah, right.
Not necessarily to something better, but just moving on.
Right, That's how life is.
Yeah.
Well, Lawrence Barker, it's been a pleasure having you on Paper Talk. Thank you so much for your contribution to the field of hand papermaking.
Well, Helen, thank you very much.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can sign up at helenhebertstudio.com to receive my e-newsletter. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed it, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps other people find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on Paper Talk, where you can find out more about them, subscribe to the series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. I'll talk to you soon.
Besides the season.